All right. Today's our last time together for Genesis, okay? I'm really refreshed every time I come Sunday because my students, like all during the week, I teach my students and they're like counting the weeks until the end of the semester, like five more, four more, three more. Are we done yet? So I'm really encouraged and refreshed every time I come here and have opportunity to study the Word together with you. I give my students a hard time. They do very well. But a long semester, 16 weeks. By the time you get to the end of 16 weeks, you've written papers, you've taken exams, I've forced them to memorize Hebrew paradigms, all kinds of things. So they're done. By the time they get to the end, they're done. All right. As I mentioned before, we have, as far as the structure of Genesis goes, Genesis 1 through 11, Genesis 12 through 50. So if you're going to divide it into two chunks, those are kind of the two major chunks. Then 12 through 50, you have these three larger narratives. So Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph. Now, we organize it or we structure it or see some of the structure that way, but that doesn't mean that we're taking everything else out. In the middle of our Joseph narrative, we're going to have a story about Judah and Tamar. And in the middle of the Abraham story, you have things that are inserted into the story. We want to pay attention. We want to pay attention to every single portion of the story and the flow, and especially those things that might stand out or be a little bit out of place. If the story is being told and then it switches to a different idea or switches to a different character or something like that, those are things we really want to pay attention to because there's emphasis that's being placed there. So the goal of every book of the Bible, let's just focus in on Genesis in particular, the goal of Genesis is not just to tell us history. It is a historical book, and we take it at face value for the history that it tells us. So when it says that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, we take that at face value. Okay, we don't try to insert a bunch of other ideas into the text. So it is a historical document. But in addition to that, the book of Genesis, like any other book in the Bible, has a goal other than just giving us historical facts. The goal of the book is to reveal God's character. The goal of the book is to help us understand more about what God is doing and how he's orchestrated the world and how God is involved in the world in order to understand his character better. So whenever we approach a book, we never want to approach it in terms only of academics, just to study it in an academic way. Our goal is always to understand the character of God from the book. What should we glean from our understanding of who God is based on the text that we're studying? So the way that the book is structured helps us to understand that because, again, it's not trying to give all of history. It's selecting very particular things. The book of Genesis is selecting very particular things, and each one of the things that is selected is meant to help us understand God in a better way. There is all kinds of history in Genesis 1 through 11 that is left out. We don't really know what that world looked like. We have the Tower of Babel as an example, and we can kind of glean and get some pieces or see what life would have been like around the time of the Tower of Babel, but we don't get a lot. Right, and we have a lot of insights, like how much technology did they have? How many people were on the world, or were on the earth in that time? What did agriculture look like? What did their cultures look like? What were the languages like? We don't gain a lot of insight into those sorts of things. It's a particular story that's told to help us understand something about God. I've made the joke maybe three or four times already that sometimes we wish that maybe some more chapters were taken out of, let's say, Leviticus or Numbers and put into Genesis, right? To tell me what was creation like, right? We have two chapters dealing with the creation of the entire universe, two chapters. Like, man, I would love to have some more chapters that give some more explanation to what did that look like, right? But that's not the intention of the book. That's not the intention to give more, to give less. Ecclesiastes gives us a very helpful statement when it says that when we come to the end, we'll recognize that nothing can be taken away, nothing can be added. Everything that God has done, including the words that he has put into his scripture, is selected for a particular reason, nothing to be added, nothing to be taken away from it. So we want to understand the scripture as it is. The other thing that we've noticed as we've been going, hopefully you've seen as we've been going through the book of Genesis, is God's kindness, God's mercy, his grace. You have a holy God who creates, who is the supreme authority for everything within the world. God names, God creates, God is the authority. And once you have the fall, it's just like again and again and again and again, sin coming into the world. People making wrong decisions, people messing up their lives, people messing up their families' lives. People causing all kinds of issues within society. People rebelling, rebelling against God. So we see this again and again and again in Genesis. And oftentimes we view the Old Testament, this is kind of a general stipulation within the church, but oftentimes we kind of view the Old Testament as, oh, God is really strict in the Old Testament. Right? There's not a lot of grace there. When we come into the New Testament and we see Jesus, we see grace that's poured out on the cross. We see the grace and the mercy through what Jesus does, how he heals people. He has compassion on them, takes pity on them. So we kind of divide it up into Old Testament, New Testament. New Testament, God of mercy. Old Testament, God of wrath. That is, when you study the Old Testament, that is exactly not the case. How many times in Genesis alone do we see the kindness and the mercy of God? Right after the fall, immediately after the fall, you have a promise from God saying, this is going to be made right. Somebody's going to come who's going to make this right. Right after Cain murders his brother, just because he was envious of him, not to get anything, just because he was envious of what his brother had. Cain murders Abel. Right after that, you would expect God is going to strike him down. God's going to kill him. No, God puts a mark on him so that nobody does kill him. God gives him punishment. God deals out punishment to Cain. He's going to be a wanderer. And he says, my punishment is too great to bear. But God places a mark upon him, lets him live. You see grace even when the entire world is corrupt. Every intention of the thought of his heart was only evil all the time. Noah. Let's preserve Noah. Let's preserve not only Noah and his wife, but his three sons and their wives, and let's start again. Let's start again. The problem is, when we start again, and Noah steps off the ark, Noah and all of his sons and all of his family still has a wicked heart. So why can we expect a different outcome? We're not going to expect a different outcome from mankind, but God still promises after the flood, I'm going to give you time. All right, I'm going to give you time. I'm going to give all of the world time. I'm not just going to send a flood every 500 years and start over again because mankind is wicked. Okay, we see grace in the life of Abraham. Blessing in the life of Abraham. Again and again, I won't go through all of the examples. Same with Isaac, same with Jacob. Now we come to Joseph. So Genesis is very much a book demonstrating God's faithfulness, demonstrating God's compassion, his mercy, and his kindness in light of great evil and great wickedness. All right, let's dive into the Joseph narrative, and what I would like to do is leave a little bit more time in the end than we have before. So like I usually leave like, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes or something at the end, but a little bit more time than previous to open up for questions on anything in Genesis, right? Because this is the last session that we have for Genesis, so. I'll try to leave that time there at the end. All right, chapter 37 starts our discussion, or starts the scripture's discussion of Joseph. Okay, chapter 36, we just breezed over last time. Chapter 36 are the descendants of Esau, right? Who's coming from Esau? Edom, right? And if you want to read more about Edom, you can read that little tiny short book of Obadiah in the Minor Prophets. Okay, so chapter 37, there's a lot of text to go through. So I've selected some key verses. We'll be kind of jumping through a couple of different verses. I'd encourage you to write them down and just make note of them as we go. But let's start chapter 37, verse 1. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. And usually when Genesis says these are the generations of something, of Jacob in this case, the story is not actually about Jacob. Jacob already had his story told. It's now on Joseph. Okay, so these are the generations of Jacob. It actually focuses in on one of Jacob's sons, Joseph in this case. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. I brought that up last time. I want you to pay attention to even a small statement like that. His father's wives. Are Bilhah and Zilpah his father's wives? No, they're actually the handmaidens of his two wives, right? Leah and Rachel. Okay, so remember, Leah starts having children. Jacob gets married to Leah. She starts having children, has a whole host of sons, and then she stops having children eventually. But Rachel prays for children, doesn't have children, and so she says, take Bilhah, my handmaid, have children with her. Jacob has two children with Bilhah, Dan and Naphtali in particular. And then Leah recognizes that Rachel has given her handmaid away, so she says, well, I'll do the same thing, right? And I'll give Zilpah, and Zilpah, you can have children with Zilpah. Gad and Asher come from that. And of course, Jacob, the text, it's just so interesting how the text describes the situation. Because Jacob's like, no, that really wouldn't be very wise. That wouldn't be very good, right? I saw my grandfather do that, and I've got some crazy cousins that are trying to kill us across the way because he made a mistake doing that. He says, well, let's learn from that mistake. Jacob doesn't do that. He says, oh, it's a great idea. Let's do that. Okay, so very interesting, though, that it mentions that it's Bilhah and Zilpah. Puts him in a category of his father's wives. And we contrast that with Keturah, with Abraham. So Abraham and Sarah passes away. And after Sarah dies, then Abraham takes another wife, Keturah, and has multiple children with Keturah. But it calls Keturah a concubine, okay, in the Abraham narrative. You say, well, she's not a concubine. Right? She's a wife. Sarah died. He took a wife, calls her a wife, but then it says the children of concubine. And you're like, why would it call them or call her a concubine? And here it says Bilhah and Zilpah are his father's wives, not concubines. Right? I don't have a great answer on this. I'm hoping myself to dig into this more. This is something, as I've been studying Genesis this most recent time, that's something that's popped out at me to say, in what way or why is it that someone would be called a concubine when they're a wife, or a wife when they're a concubine? Why this disagreement, if you will? Maybe I'll use that word. Okay, it doesn't. There's obviously intention in the text, but why is that the case? Okay, is it emphasizing the legitimacy of the children? So when Keturah, this is my best idea right now, okay, when Keturah is called a concubine, it's in terms of her children, okay? So the children that she has do not have inheritance. They don't have inheritance in the same way, okay, as Isaac does, okay? Ishmael is the same thing, doesn't have inheritance in the same way. So in speaking of the children, they're not considered to inherit in the same regard. But Bilhah and Zilpah, the four sons from Bilhah and Zilpah, are. right? They are considered legitimate. You're the same. You're on the same. You're within the tribe. You're one of the legitimate tribes of Israel. All right. Joseph, it says here, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought back an evil report about them to their father. So he's a tattletale. Okay, he's a tattletale. We're going to get some of Joseph's character in just a second. Leo. Yeah. Yeah. Right. They're not all from Leah. They're not all from Rachel. They're not all from Bilhah or Zilpah. They're all spread out. Leah has the most, right? Leah has the most. Leah has six of the 12. And she has the firstborn as well, Reuben. Yeah.
Blessing,
yeah.
Primary wife, mm-hmm. The children
get to
inherit.
Yep.
And now
it's exactly. Exactly right. Yeah. And we're going to see a mix up. We're going to see a change up in terms of, legitimacy, right? All of those 12 tribes, they're all considered as 12 tribes. In fact, at the very end, when we see the blessing of Jacob to Joseph, we're going to see that Jacob takes Joseph's two sons and calls them his own. Okay, so at that point, there's actually 13. And we're going to say, well, who disappeared, right? Dan is going to disappear. The lost tribe. Yeah, yeah. So Leah has the firstborn, Reuben. She has Simeon. She has Levi. She has Judah. And she has six in total. And from Rachel, you have Joseph and you have Benjamin, right? So Benjamin plays a fairly important role, plays a prominent role. Saul is from Benjamin. Benjamin plays a very interesting role in the book of Judges, very negative role in the book of Judges, but an important role after. Benjamin joins in with Judah, right, for the southern kingdom. When the kingdom is split, it's Benjamin and Judah and Levi, in a sense, you know, Levites together. And then the north is the other 10. And so, yeah, we'll notice several things as we go through Jacob and his relationship to Leah in small snippets. Even while we're going through the Joseph narrative, it's going to come out more and more. Okay, so Joseph, he's a tattletale. He's 17. It's a good age, okay? Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all of his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a multicolored tunic. And you're like, that's good, but you all know that colors in clothing at that time are expensive and rare, right? You don't just go to the store and grab some dye. You have to figure out where it's coming from, how to get it. I mean, there's imported dyes from across the world, because the only place to get them is from, you know, the shell of a particular mollusk who only is, you know, in the sub-Saharan region. But they're coming from quite a ways away. So it's an expensive tunic. Okay, so he gives him that. Anytime you have a detail that's mentioned in the text, you always want to pay attention to that detail and see where it comes up again. Right, so he probably gave him other things, right? He's not just giving him only a multicolored tunic, but he's giving him other things as well. He's blessing him in other ways. Clearly, he's showing favoritism. This is an example of him showing favoritism to Joseph, but he shows favoritism, but you say, why in particular the tunic? Because it's going to come up again later. And in terms of color, again later, right? Because let's put the blood on the tunic and cover over the multicolored or stain it with the blood of an animal to lie to our father that Joseph has been killed by an animal. Okay, so all his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him in peace. I'll take a second to talk about families in Genesis. There's not there's not a lot of great characteristics in Genesis in terms of families. Obviously, much of this problem is going to stem from multiple wives. Okay, so what's the issue? What's the issue with Jacob? Well, he's got two wives. Okay, two wives, two handmaidens as well. Okay, so we have issues and problems arising from that, of course. But you have Abraham, who sells his wife down the river, saying, "Oh, she's my sister. You know, if you want to take her, just spare me." Isaac does the same thing. And so there's a lot of issues when it comes to families in Genesis. Again, we want to pay attention to the kindness of God, the patience of God with these individuals. All right, you know the story. Joseph has two dreams. He has two dreams, and in the first dream, his brothers are bowing down to him, and he is very, very happy to tell his brothers the dream. "Hey, I had this prophetic dream, and in my dream, you're all bowing down to me." And he gets his brothers all riled up, and they're envious, jealous of him. One thing that we're going to talk about as we go through the Joseph narrative is the emphasis on dreams. Now, we've seen dreams before, right? Jacob, with the ladder, he goes to sleep with a rock as a pillow, remember, in Bethel, and he has a dream about a ladder touching the top of heaven, angels coming up and down on that ladder. Okay, so we see dreams in other places, but there is a great emphasis in the story of Joseph on dreams. There's the two dreams that he has here. There's also the dreams that he interprets, three separate dreams that he interprets later on. Okay, so there's an emphasis on dreams. We're going to come back to that and the place of interpreting dreams, that sort of a thing, as we get towards the end with Joseph. So I'll leave it aside just for now. But even in his second dream, you can see in chapter 37, verses 9 through 10, he has a second dream, and in that second dream, sun, moon, and stars are bowing down to him, and he says, "Oh, my parents are bowing down to me as well." And even Jacob is like, "What are you talking about?" And he gets, even his father, who loves him, favors him, even his father gets a little offended. Okay, so you kind of, you get a picture as to the character of Joseph, you get a picture as to what he's like. Okay, he's a young guy. He's been spoiled his whole life, and his life is drastically about to change. Take a look at chapter 37 as well, verse 21. The brothers in the Joseph story, as Joseph is being sold to Egypt, the brothers are all kind of viewed as being a uniform whole. Like, let's take him, let's cast him into the pit, let's figure out what to do with him, let's kill him, or let's sell him, or whatever that it is. But there's two individuals that stand out, and that's Reuben first of all, and then Judah after that. So Reuben, verse 21, Reuben heard this, and he delivered Joseph out of their hands and said, "Let us not strike down his life." And Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Cast him into the pit that's in the wilderness. Do not put forth your hand against him, that he might deliver him out of their hands to return him to his father." So Reuben, as the firstborn, does a very good thing and says, let me get in the middle of this, save and preserve Joseph's life, because I intend to give him back to his father and make sure that they don't kill him. Okay, so the brothers strip him of the tunic. They throw him into a pit. It says the pit's empty, didn't have any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal, right? And you're like, this is really not depicting them in a positive light, right? All of these various brothers, they're about to murder someone, and their intention is to murder someone. Not only that, they're all trying to do it together, except for Reuben here. And they throw him into a pit. They sit down and they eat a meal. And they're like, let's plot out. Let's have a nice meal, take some time, figure out what we want to do with him. How are we going to kill him? Okay, they're not viewed in a very good light at all. They see a caravan of Ishmaelites who are coming. And Ishmaelites, of course, you see the connection, right? From Joseph, Ishmaelites coming down from Ishmael, Abraham. All right, chapter 37, verse 26. Judah said to his brothers, again, Judah stands out In contrast to all of the brothers, Judah stands out and says, what gain is it that we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. So Judah comes up with the idea, hey, let's sell him on down the river to Egypt, and let's not kill him. Okay, so he stands up, but not in the same way that Reuben does. Reuben has a very good idea, saying, I need to get in the middle of this, preserve his life, and deliver him back to his father. Judah says, we don't have to kill him. Let's sell him and get rid of him, but not bring him back to his father. Yes, sir. Yeah.
What do they have? I mean, it's yeah. Back, I mean, what do they, is it like oral?
Yeah, exactly. It's a very good question, right? How do they know the laws? How do they know how to act? All of those sorts of things. You have the presence of God in a closer way, like Abraham, right? Where God's still removed. People are calling on the name of the Lord. So it's not like he's just walking around amongst everybody at this point. But it is oral. To answer the question in a simple way, right, it is oral tradition at this point. God has said this, right? Noah comes out of the ark, stipulations given, laws given. So it is being passed down orally. Yeah. I would also emphasize that because of the long life of people, you have a lot more overlap, right? It's not, okay, you know, 50 years, this person dies, 60 years, this person dies. There's not as much turnover. I have to go back. Noah overlaps with Abraham. They didn't necessarily meet, but they overlap in age a few decades. Okay, so he sells them on down the river to the Ishmaelites. Reuben comes back, verse 29, said Reuben returned to the pit, apparently intending to lift him up, take him back to his father. Reuben returned to the pit. Behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. That's a sign of what's happened here. That's a sign of mourning. Okay, so Reuben is depicted as the firstborn. He's depicted in a very positive light here, right? Not blameless in total, but he's trying to do the right thing. Okay, one thing that I'll point out, 37 verse 26. Verse 28, then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit, sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt, right? 20 shekels of silver, and you say, why does it mention the money amount, right? The specific price is listed there, sold him for 20 shekels of silver, right? Dan and I were talking just a little bit before about knowing how far to push the text and what the text is trying to get you to think of, and also being conservative and not reading too much into the text. Okay, so how far do we take that 20 shekels of silver? Sometimes it's depicted as like Joseph is the a type, right, of Christ who is to come. Obviously, Christ sold for silver. Jesus is sold, or Judas, I should say, gets 30 shekels of silver, right, for Jesus. Okay, Joseph gets 20. So you're like, well, where's that coming from? Is there a connection there? Do we need to see a connection there? I wouldn't push it too much. If you turn to Leviticus 27:5. Say again? Yeah. Well, that's, what is that? 33% inflation over what, 1,000 years, or more than that, 2,000 years? That's not bad at all. Leviticus 27:5. This has to do with making a vow. So it's a valuation. Unfortunately, I'm not doing a section in or sessions in Leviticus. But if we did, then we'd be looking at chapter 27. But verse 5, it says, making a valuation for someone in terms of a vow. If it be from 5 years even to 20 years old, then your valuation for the male shall be 20 shekels, for the female 10 shekels. So it has to do with a valuation for a vow a whole bunch of things going on there. But from a certain age, okay, a certain time period, you have someone who is valued at 20 shekels. Okay, it's not saying that they're only ever worth 20 shekels of silver, but it's placing a valuation having to do with a vow. Okay, Joseph fits within that time period. Okay, so he fits within the age range. So he sold for 20 shekels of silver. Okay, you can take a look at Exodus 21:32. Let me just turn there really quick. Exodus 21:32. This is talking about injury to a slave. Okay, injury to a slave. Exodus 21:32. If someone has an ox and the bull or the ox gores a slave, then the owner shall give his master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox is to be killed. Okay, so if you have a slave and you have an animal that kills a slave, something happens, it gets out, whatever happens, and that person dies, you have to pay 30 shekels of silver to the slave owner. Okay, again, it's not saying their life is only worth this amount. Okay, it has to do with the legality of it. So you have 30 shekels of silver there. So the fact that Joseph is sold for 20 shekels of silver is like, that's just the normal valuation that was placed upon someone at that age. Okay, at 17 years old, if you're going to sell someone into slavery, you're going to get 20 shekels of silver. Okay, Jesus is sold for 30 shekels of silver, apparently the price of a slave after that age. Okay, so if you have a slave who is past the age of 20, okay, they're going to be sold, or the recompense is 30 shekels of silver. So there is emphasis when Jesus is sold, there is emphasis upon the fact that Jesus is sold for 30 pieces of silver. Why? Because they're saying that's all we're valuing him as. As a normal person, 30 shekels of silver, this is what he's worth, and they move on, okay? He's just viewed as a common slave would be by the Pharisees. Okay, so Joseph is sold for 20, because that's just the valuation that you would have for someone of his particular age, 20 shekels of silver. All right, so he is sold down into Egypt. We'll come back to that. Now we have this very interesting chapter 38, and Judah is at the forefront here. And Judah is not depicted as being a very great guy. Okay, he's not depicted as being a very moral person. He has three sons. He gets a daughter of a Canaanite took a wife for Er, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar, verse 6. So Judah marries a Canaanite, and he gets a Canaanite woman for his son, right? And that's very different from what we've seen before. Abraham has Isaac, and Abraham sends his servant halfway around the known world to get a wife for Isaac, not from the Canaanites. Okay, and then you have Isaac who begets Jacob and Esau. And Esau takes two wives for himself from the Canaanites and says they caused Isaac and Rebekah no end of grief, no end of problems. But Jacob is then sent off. And the reason why he's sent off is because Rebekah tells Isaac, you need to make sure that he gets married to someone not Canaanite. Go back to where we came from, get a wife from there. Okay, so there's this emphasis on going back to get a wife, but we come to the 12 sons, and we're like, who did they marry? Canaanites. And even Joseph, by the time we get to the end, who did Joseph marry? An Egyptian woman. Okay, and there's no direct statement that's like, they did wrong here. This is an issue here. Okay, or this is syncretism, or this is, obviously Judah doesn't do very good with how he's treating his daughter-in-law. But they take Canaanites, or they take women from around the area, right? They're not going all the way back, back to Haran or whatnot to get a wife. Okay, so so Judah marries a Canaanite and also gets a wife for his son, his firstborn. And it just says in verse 7 that his firstborn, heir, was evil in the sight of Yahweh. So Yahweh put him to death. Right? Why? What did he do? Not mentioned. He's just evil. Okay, so Yahweh puts him to death. And then Judah says to his second son, because they were married, okay, because Er was married to Tamar, okay, she has the right to have children from that. Okay, so if the husband dies, then the brother takes the wife to produce children with her so that she has children that she's begetting. Okay, children even to take care of her in her old age, so on and so forth. Okay, Onan does not do that, so God puts him to death as well. Okay, and then Judah's third son, Shua, he says, I'm worried that he's going to die too, so let me hold back on him. He doesn't treat Tamar according to God's stipulations of what should be done. And so Judah does wrong by Tamar. You remember the story. Tamar dresses up as a harlot. And Judah pays her, okay, as a harlot, doesn't know who she is. She conceives. And the twist, or the interesting thing that happens is verse 24. Now it happened about 3 months later, okay, 3 months after she conceives, that it was told to Judah, saying, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. Behold, she is with child by harlotry. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Like, we got a bit of a double standard. Okay, we got a bit of a double standard here. Right? Bring her out and let her be burned. Like, this should never, ever happen. How could she have done this? Right? And the whole time, he's, you know, I'm on the road, right? I got to shear my sheep over in this other city, passing by. Let me find a prostitute. Okay, and so she brings out, she got his signet ring from him, cords and a staff, and said, hey, these are yours, right? And he recognizes, oh, you were the prostitute. So the question, it's a crazy story. I mean, it's difficult to read, to see how people are treating each other in such horrible ways in chapter 38. The question is, why is 38 in the location that it is? What's going on? Why did we were talking about Joseph and setting up this whole story for Joseph, and then we just insert chapter 38? Why? Why is that necessary? Why is that important? The other time that we see Judah is that he preserves the life of Joseph. He doesn't kill Joseph or go along with the plot to kill Joseph, but he sells him on down to Egypt. Okay, so not the best thing to do by any means. And then Genesis 38 gives us one of the most pronounced windows or glimpses into who Judah is. What's his character like? What kind of a person is he? That's the same thing that we asked with the others, right? Abraham, what kind of a person is he? Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, we're going to see in a little bit. Joseph starts to stand out. We'll see in just a little bit. But when you look at Judah, the tribe of Judah obviously plays the central role moving forward. Okay, and we'll see that at the end in Genesis 49, and the promise is given there. But in any case, you have Judah, who's, what kind of person is he? Not a great one. Not a great person. What are the other brothers like? Not great people. Everybody except Reuben Reuben and Judah are trying to kill their brother. Okay, so I have 10 tribes or 9 that are, they're trying to kill their brother. And you have Joseph. You have Reuben, who apparently tries to do the right thing. He's going to be condemned later, though. Okay, and then you have Judah, who doesn't want to kill his brother but sells him into slavery and really doesn't do very good here in chapter 38. And you say, like, why is God working with these people? What is going on? Why is God working with these people? Why? Simple. He made a promise to Abraham, who's not a great guy. But he made a promise to Abraham, and he always keeps his promises. Okay, chapter 39. Actually, let me back up just for a second, right? So Tamar has twins, Perez and Zerah. And Perez comes up again later in the book of Ruth. Okay, the book of Ruth, because you have the line of David traced back to Perez. So there's anytime you have someone who's begetting another person, giving birth or begetting another person in Genesis, pay attention because we're tracing the line. Genesis 3:15, we're tracing that line. So we have these very important genealogies that are given. We have small stories like this. Where did Perez come from? And we have very important statements in Genesis 49. We'll see in a little bit. All right, Genesis 39, Joseph's in Potiphar's house. I'm not going to go through all of the story again just for the sake of time. But Joseph's in Potiphar's house. The one thing to pay attention, there's more than one, but the key things to pay attention to Joseph is that he seemed to like totally change his character, right? He goes down into Egypt, and you expect he's young, and he's spoiled, he's soft, he's not doing all the work that his brothers are doing. Like, what responsibilities has he had? What kind of a person is he? But he goes down into Egypt and he just like switches character, right? Switches character. And you see that he becomes a slave, but he becomes a slave in Potiphar's house, a very important person, rises to the top of that. And he's like, okay, like I could do this for the rest of my life, right? I'm living well. I'm treated well. I'm, as far as slaves go, you're doing pretty good in that situation. And Genesis 39, verse 9, I want you to pay attention to that. Potiphar's wife comes to Joseph. Joseph is speaking. He says, "There is no one greater in this house than I. And he, Potiphar, has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against Potiphar?" Doesn't say Potiphar, right? That is very important. That is very, very important. He's in Egypt. There's a whole host of gods in Egypt. His brother sold him down the river. He's all by himself. He's all alone. You'd think, well, he's just trying to get by. He's a chameleon. Maybe he's trying to just do whatever he can to climb the ladder, to get up to the top. But Joseph, in that statement, "How could I do this great evil and sin against God?" That statement shows that he's holding himself to a higher moral standard. And you're like, where did that come from? There was just a spoiled 17-year-old kid coming down into Egypt. Now he's a slave and he's at the bottom of the rung. And you'd think, man, walking into Egypt, into the slave market, like what's going through his thoughts? What is he thinking about? How do I get out of this? How do I get back home? How do I not, you know, be sold to someone who's going to be horrible to me for the next 30 years? How do I this? How do I that? But that statement right there, "Do this great sin against God," shows that he has a moral standard that he's holding himself to. The consistent refrain, of course, in the life of Joseph is that God blesses him. And I want you to think about this blessing going all the way back to creation, right? We talked about blessing and curse. You have blessing that comes about. God says, "I will bless you, multiply, face of the earth." And blessing is that how things ought to be, okay? When there's no sin, when there's no corruption, when there's no twisting of relationships, and when there's no wickedness, it's the state of being blessed. It's the state of whatever I do, whatever I put my hand to, hundredfold. Yield. There's no hindrance. There's no weeds I got to deal with. There's no this. There's no that. There's no murder. There's no fracturing of things that happens. So once we have the fall, then it's a question of how do we get back to the blessing, right? How do we get back to the way things ought to be, right? Which, of course, is based in the relationship with God. So you see this blessing go through, that God is blessing all of these individuals. Remember Abraham? Fabulously wealthy. It got blessing. Why? Because he's a good guy? Because he put in his promise amount to you know, to the faith healer and says, if you give $10 and I give you $1,000 back? No. God just blesses him, period. Blesses Isaac, period. Blesses Jacob, period. Blesses Joseph, period. Why? Because he just blessed them. And people around them are noticing that, right? Potiphar notices it. Says, everything that you do, it succeeds. Everything that you do succeeds. I'm going to put you in charge. Okay, Joseph is thrown down into the jail. The jailer recognizes after a while, oh, everything that you're doing is succeeding. Let me put you in charge. Okay, and then he comes to this period where he's like, am I ever going to get out of this jail? Well, he's exalted up to Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, you're blessed. What you're doing, you're speaking truth. You're giving insight. What you're doing is blessing. Let me put you up at the top. Okay, so Joseph is put into jail. He interprets the two dreams, chapter 40. And then interprets the two dreams, of course, the cupbearer and the baker. Cupbearer goes first. I always feel really bad for the baker. Cupbearer goes first and tells a dream. And Joseph gives like this great, you know, oh, you're gonna be exalted again. You're taken out of jail. And the baker's like, yeah, it's like almost exactly the same kind of dream that I had. I feel really bad for the baker. Okay. But the cupbearer forgets Joseph. Chapter 40, verse 23. Forgets Joseph. Chapter 41. He remembers Joseph when Pharaoh is having this dream, and Pharaoh is vexed. Pharaoh has an issue. He doesn't have insight. The guys that are around him who are supposed to interpret for him can't give him an answer. Pharaoh's dream is vexing him, and the cupbearer remembers, oh, right, Joseph. He knows how to interpret dreams. And then chapter 41, not only is Joseph exalted, But not only does Joseph interpret dreams, but he's exalted as well. Say, towards the end of Genesis, he'll say that I have become as a father to Pharaoh, okay? Which gives me the idea probably that Joseph might have been older. I don't know if this Pharaoh, it's not necessarily, doesn't have to be the case, but I wonder if the Pharaoh was quite young. I don't know exactly how old that Joseph is when he's exalted over Egypt. But in any case, it seems as though the Pharaoh might be young. And then you have this lengthy set of chapters, 42, 43, 44. The brothers come down into Egypt because Joseph has preserved food for everybody. He opens up the storehouses. You all know the story of this. Brothers come down. Joseph doesn't believe them, doesn't reveal himself to them. Simeon is held hostage in the jail. Brothers go back, and you kind of think, yeah, they're thinking, we're just like, that was a casualty. That was a loss. Like, we lost one brother already. Simeon, he's in jail until we come back, but maybe we just leave him there. Do we really need to go get him? Okay, but Simeon, remember that Simeon from Leah. Okay, Simeon does hold a very important place with the brothers in terms of age. Okay, so Simeon's held hostage. So Joseph claims that he doesn't believe them about Benjamin coming from Rachel. And so they convince Jacob, once their food is gone again, they convince Jacob, they let us go down into Egypt. We need to take Benjamin this time. They come down into Egypt, of course. And Simeon is released because they bring Benjamin. Okay, and let's just go to chapter 44, verse 15. This is a question. This is the a major question that I have about Joseph. And obviously, this is a very different world than what we're living in. It's the same, and it's also different. Okay, but Joseph, he has this ability to interpret dreams. And chapter 44, verse 15, Joseph said to them, what is this deed that you have done? Do you not know that such a man as I can interpret omens? And there's this idea about Joseph being someone who does divination. Okay, the Hebrew word that's used there, the root of it, nachash, is the same word for snake. Okay, same root word, root three letters for snake. You know, like, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? What do you mean by divination? What are you talking about? Okay, is there, in Joseph's mind, is there some kind of syncretism where he clearly is like, God's the one who's sovereign, who's in control, who's guiding my way, who's delivering me through all of these things. But then we have like this undercurrent in Joseph's life about divination and the place that he's in, interpreting omens for Pharaoh and that sort of thing. You're like, what exactly is going on there? Is that a negative thing? Is that a good thing? What's happening? Okay, it's kind of the same, different with Daniel, but still kind of similar, right? Ability to foretell, ability to interpret dreams, or what's the relationship between false religion and this? Or is this just Joseph saying, God's given me the ability to interpret dreams and to at some times peer into the future in terms even of the dream that he gives, foretelling what's going to happen? Okay, is there any like syncretism when it comes to the other gods? Okay, it's hard to know, but I want to emphasize Joseph's positive character. Once he goes down into Egypt, it seems as though he's has a moral code that he's living by, and he's saying, I will live in a certain way, even though I'm all by myself, no one knows that I'm here. I don't have any expectation of going back home. I'm a slave in another country. But he still is living in a certain way, right? And that way, he's also very similar to Daniel, where Daniel is going to Babylon, and he goes with other Israelites or other Jews. He's like, we're in a brand new country. We're young men. How do we live? And Daniel purposes in his heart and says, I will live like this. I will live in this way. So there's some similarity, at least in terms of themes, between Joseph and Daniel. Joseph is testing the brothers to see if they're going to give up Benjamin. So the story is, they all start to go back, but the cup of divination from the previous section where we just read is placed in Benjamin's sack, like he stole it. Okay, Joseph sets him up. And so they all go after the brothers on their way back, and they bring them back down into Egypt. And the story is this: what are you going to do when your youngest brother is about to be put into slavery, right? How are you brothers going to react to this? And you have the brothers who say, it would kill our father if we can't protect Benjamin. And so Joseph isn't able to keep quiet anymore, and so he reveals himself to his brothers. Chapter 45, verse 7. Let's start in verse 6. Joseph speaking after he reveals himself. After he reveals himself to his brothers, and after Judah saying, let me stay instead of Benjamin, okay, a positive light on Judah. Verse 6 of chapter 45, Joseph speaking to Jacob, saying to come down into Egypt, for the famine has been in the land these 2 years. There are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. So God sent me before you to establish for you a remnant in the earth, to keep you alive for a great remnant of survivors. Okay, so this is going to be a horrible famine. He recognizes that. And Joseph says, hey, isn't it such a great thing that I'm in the position that I am? No, he says, God put me here. God's orchestrated this. Joseph's able to look back on his life and say, I see the hand of God at work in all of these things. I see how God has orchestrated all of these things. And in several instances, several places that Joseph attributes everything that's happened to him to God's providence. Okay, so God has sent me before you to establish a remnant, to keep everybody alive, to keep that seed alive, right? So God is using Joseph in a particular way. Uh, Notice in chapter 46, verses 1 through 4, that Jacob is on display again. And the focus up until this point, we switched from Jacob over to Joseph. We have a little caveat given with Judah, but the focus remains on Joseph and from Joseph's perspective, if you will, until we get to chapter 46, verses 1 through 4. It switches back and it's God speaking to Jacob. So Israel set with him all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel, right, in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. He said, here I am. He said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I myself will bring you up again. And Joseph will close your eyes with his hand. So there's this beautiful emphasis, this beautiful explanation of God's telling Jacob, here's what you can expect. You're going to go down into Egypt. You're going to see your son again. He's going to close your eyes. Rest in peace, Jacob, and I'm going to bring you up again. Okay, so the emphasis or the focus comes back on Jacob. You can see chapter 47, verse 9. You can see the interaction that Jacob has with Pharaoh. Pharaoh calls Jacob before him, and Pharaoh is like, man, you're really old. And Jacob says, that's verse 8, right, of chapter 47. So Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many are the days of the years of your life? Like they just meet and you have this, it's like the Pharaoh's like, how old are you again? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and evil have been the years of my life, and they have not attained to the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. Okay, so few and evil. He's 130 years old, but he's still like, I'm not anywhere near the age of my fathers. Okay, according to chapter 47, verse 28, Jacob lives a total of 147 years. So he's 17 years down in Egypt before Jacob dies. Just really quick, turn to Hebrews 11. I do want to point this out. This gives us more insight. Hall of Faith is very important for us in terms of who's mentioned and studying the Old Testament, how they're mentioned. But Hebrews 11, verse 21. Okay, Hebrews 11, 21, by faith Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. By faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave commands concerning his bones. Okay, so it's two short verses, but those short verses are like, here's the example of the faithfulness of these individuals. Okay, it doesn't say, by faith Jacob married two women, and took two concubines. Jacob obviously is making many mistakes in his life. But the thing that Hebrews, the author of Hebrews, wants us to understand about Jacob is his blessing of his sons. Okay, and we're going to come to that in just a second. But the blessing of the sons, and then the key thing to notice about Joseph is that Joseph says, I want my bones to be taken out of here. Right, so the bones are put into a box, and Joseph says, I know that we're not going to be in Israel. Like, we're not just here to amalgamate or to come together with the Egyptians. I know we're going to be distinct, and I know that we are going to come up out of Egypt. And so just that statement of Joseph, put my bones in a box, carry them with me, as you go, points to the faith that he has. Okay, let's turn to chapter 48. So Genesis 48 again. I want to mention one thing before we get into Genesis 49. Genesis 48. You have Jacob, Israel, who is old, getting old, and so he says, I'm going to bless my sons now before I die. We kind of poked a little bit of fun at Isaac last time because he blesses his sons like 60-something years before he dies. He's like, I'm about to die. Let me bless you. But he lives for a long time after that. Not the case with Jacob. Okay, Jacob, Israel, he's very old. And he says, I'm going to bless my sons before I die. And chapter 48, Joseph has two sons. And Joseph, he marries an Egyptian wife named Asenath. And she is daughter of an Egyptian priest. We think of maybe Heliopolis, a high priest of a particular city. Okay, and he has two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Manasseh is firstborn, Ephraim is second. But when Jacob blesses them, he blesses Ephraim as though Ephraim was the firstborn, and Manasseh as though he was the secondborn. Look at verse 5, 48 verse 5. So now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. Okay, so Reuben, firstborn, Simeon, secondborn of Israel, and Jacob says, your two sons, I'm counting them as my sons. I'm not counting them as my grandsons, but as my sons, which is why we have tribes Manasseh and Ephraim, right? Joseph is split into two, into those two tribes. Okay, and then Jacob blesses Ephraim as though he's Manasseh, and Joseph is like, whoa, 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 no, don't do that. And he tries to reverse it, or he tries to put his hands, you know, the opposite way. And Jacob says, no, this is how it ought to be. It's just a really interesting play on the fact that Jacob spent his whole life, you know, or he spent his life trying to get the blessing from his brother, his older brother, okay, and how that came about. Remember that story? But kind of a small snippet of Ephraim being blessed as the firstborn, even though Manasseh actually is the firstborn. We won't have time here, but I would encourage you to look at 1 Chronicles 7, 20 through 29. And we gain like a little glimpse insight into Ephraim there, not just his descendants. I would really encourage you to read that maybe later today. 1 Chronicles 7, 20 through 29. All right, Genesis 49. Genesis 49 is the blessing of Jacob on his sons. And we call it the blessing of Jacob on his sons, but not all of the sons are blessed, let's say. Not in a very positive way. So 49, Jacob summoned his sons and said, gather together that I may tell you what will befall you in the last days. So here's that additional glimpse. Like the blessing of someone is to say, here is what you can expect is going to happen of you, right? In a sense, it's like it's prophetic. Okay, so assemble together and hear, O sons of Jacob, listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my vigor, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in strength. So Reuben did some good things, okay? He's viewed a positive in a couple of places, but verse 4 says, uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed, you defiled it, and he went up to my couch. Okay, so Reuben laid with Bilhah. I believe it's Bilhah, either Bilhah or Zilpah. But he laid with them, and that decision to do that means that he is not to be considered as preeminent, as the first. Okay, he's uncontrolled as like water. He has no self-control. Simeon and Levi, verse 5, their swords are implements of violence. Remember what happened to their sister Dinah. And I mentioned last time, I think that I put emphasis on Dinah, but we do think that Joseph had, or that Jacob had other daughters other than Dinah. Genesis 37, 35 would point to that, right? That he had other daughters other than Dinah. Dinah is the only one that's mentioned. I think I misspoke last time. Okay, so Simeon and Levi, their swords are implements of violence, right? When Dinah is defiled, they go in and they slaughtered a city, okay, in retribution. Okay, let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Cursed be their anger. and their wrath. I will divide them amongst Jacob and scatter them in Israel. That's very interesting, especially with Levi, because Levi, the tribe of Levi, great prominence, in terms of the temple and the temple worship, great prominence, but they're all scattered. So there's a large section in Torah speaking about the cities that are given to the Levites, because they don't have place within the giving of the land in the same way that the other tribes do. They're dispersed. Special attention given to Judah. So Judah as fourth born, again, of Leah, Judah, verse 8, as for you, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. That's interesting, huh? We had Joseph saying, they're all bowing down to me. Now, Judah, the prophecy that's given, your father's sons, your brothers shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. Crouches, he lies down as a lioness who dares rouse him. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. There's all kinds of debate about Shiloh. What is Shiloh referring to? Who is it? An individual? Something else? Pay special attention to the start of verse 10, though. The scepter and the ruler's staff belongs to Judah. So Judah is the ruler. Judah is meant to be preeminent amongst the tribes. I got a great question from somebody, I think last time, but you have in the book of Judges, there seems to be like this question of who's leading, right? So you have Moses writing Torah. Moses is the leader of Israel, bringing them up out of Egypt. And then you have it passed very clearly from Moses to Joshua, okay? And Joshua becomes the leader. Well, then Joshua dies, and it seems as though it's like, well, good luck. See what happens here. But the rulership passes to Judah. We see that in the beginning. We see that in the beginning portion of Judges. Okay, so in any case, the ruler's staff, the scepter, is not to depart from Judah. Until Shiloh comes, to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. I take that as an individual. Okay, singular as an individual, until Shiloh comes. Who's coming? I would connect it in with Genesis 3:15. Again, there's all kinds of debate. That word Shiloh, is it a name? It can mean him to whom it belongs, okay, as well. There's some ambiguity. The text that we have in Genesis 49 in the Hebrew is very difficult to translate. It's probably one of the most difficult chapters in the Old Testament, which doesn't give us a great deal of help. I make my students at times go through Genesis 49, and they think, like reading in Genesis, they're like, oh, I can read Hebrew, I can do this, and they, you know, piece through it, and they get to Genesis 49, they're like, what is going on? This is a completely different language. Okay, it's very, very different. So there's a question about Shiloh, but I do take Shiloh as being an individual, speaking of Messiah who's coming, okay, from Judah. Okay, to him belongs the obedience of the peoples, plural, not just to him belongs the obedience of Israel or the nation or the 12 tribes, okay, but the peoples, plural, okay, everyone. You can go through the rest, of course, of those. Talks about Zebulun, he's going to dwell on the seashore. Isaac is a strong donkey. That's a great description. Dan shall render justice to his people. Dan shall be a serpent in the way. There's some really interesting imagery that's used. It can be difficult to pin down exactly what's being spoken of. If you want to know or want to chat more about any one of these, I'm happy to chat about it as well. Gad listed, raiders shall raid him, but he will raid at their heels. Asher, his food shall be rich. Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. Then he gives Joseph, right? And Joseph, of course, Joseph split into two tribes. Take a look at Genesis 49, verse 31. I want to point this out. Jacob breathes last. He dies. Verse 31, they take Jacob back to Canaan. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. There I buried Leah. So when they asked Jacob, where do you want to be buried? He says, you need to take me. I'm going to die. You need to take me back to Canaan. You need to bury me where Abraham is buried, where Isaac is buried, Sarah, Rebekah, and where I buried Leah. Okay, so Jacob is buried next to Leah. Rachel has her own grave elsewhere. Okay, so when Jacob is asked where to be buried, he says, bury me next to Leah. Very interesting emphasis there. Joseph, Genesis 50, 22 through 26, Joseph lives to be 110 in Egypt, dies in Egypt, and Exodus 13, 19, as Israel is exiting Egypt and going out of Egypt, they take the bones of Joseph with them. Very, very important. Obviously, we see that, of course, in Hebrews 11. Okay. All of this sets up Exodus. I don't have plans to go through Exodus at this point. I'll let you read on or continue on with an Exodus, but I do want to open it up for questions. And I would say questions at any part of Genesis. I know that's very broad, but anything that's been kind of burning in your mind or issues, problems, I'm happy to answer, help answer if I can.
Okay, help me out
here. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Tamar, yep. And
yep.
Okay, it seemed like God was helping the woman.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And it brings my mind back to the New Testament where the woman that was caught in adultery was brought before Jesus and the men. And God was helping the woman.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I would say in the Old Testament, women on the whole are not treated very well. As the way that the culture is structured, and the way that the cultures are structured is there's a great deal of warfare, violence, just amongst people. And so having someone who provides protection in a world like that, where there is so much upheaval and violence, having protection is of utmost importance. So for women, I'm making very general statements, but for women, protection was incredibly important. So you stay in your father's home because your father's providing protection for you. You're married, you act in a certain way because of protection, because you're the husband, the father is providing, but offering you protection. Once a woman steps outside of that, that's where a great deal of shame comes in. Whether she's a prostitute or not, once she steps outside of that, it's who's your head? Who's protecting you? Who's taking care of you? And so you even see this in Song of Songs, right? Where the brothers are speaking. They say, if our sister is like an open door, then we need to like lock her away. If she's a wall, right, and she's guarding off people and she's not a loose morally, then we'll adorn her, right? We'll give her gold, we'll give her gifts and adorn her. So very, very different culture. But you're exactly right that there in the Old Testament, there is a great deal of violence that is done against women. And you see women are all different kinds of stories. Like Tamar, as an example, should she have done what she did? The text isn't saying that she should have done what she did. It's saying she did this. What does that tell us about Judah, right? She had the right to have children. Judah denied that to her and did not take care of her as he should have in that way. And so Judah is on display as being, he's not doing what he's supposed to do because he's worried about losing his other son, who probably is also not a very great guy. So Judah's on display. Should Tamar have done what she did? Should she have acted in a different way? Yes. I wouldn't, I mean, it's, when we get to the New Testament, we have more clear stipulations about how people interact, especially within the church and what that looks like. In the Old Testament, especially like into Judges, right, it's a Wild West. And so key issues are protection and provision. Where are we getting that from? And then in terms of men acting or interacting together, it's all who's going to do violence to who, right? Is this group going to attack me? Or do I need to run, right? Jacob and Esau. Jacob's trying to divide up his camps to make sure that Esau, if Esau attacks one, that he can get away. Everything is viewed in terms of warfare. I shouldn't say everything, but a great deal is viewed in terms of warfare, right? I meet somebody new on the road, just walking along. Is this somebody who's going to attack me and try to kill me and take everything? Or is this someone that I can depend on? I mean, it's just a very, very different time, very different culture. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
From the lineage of David. So mm-hmm. We know that as we read through Samuel, et cetera. But Jacob didn't know that.
Right.
For my knowledge. So that's the first time
in
49 that we know that Jesus was come from the line of Judah.
Yeah.
My question is, how did Jacob know, or was this something that the Lord taught? Clearly, God revealed it, even though we don't know.
Good. Exactly. Very good. So there's an idea. It's a very good question. There's an idea that we're going to have an individual from Genesis 3:15, right after the fall. We have an idea that there is an individual who is coming. Singular individual who's going to come, who's going to set things right. Now, that's a very broad statement. To set things right, what does that look like? They understood that that person has to be political in the sense of a ruler. Right, because you're going to set things right in terms of politics, in terms of making things correct in the way that nations are interacting with each other, that individual has to have the power to do that. That individual also has to be religious. In speaking in terms of like the role of a priest, right? And so there's all these different stipulations that are kind of laid out and woven through as you're thinking about who is that individual, who is that one who is to come. And so there's the tracing of that line that goes all the way down through Genesis and past Genesis as well. And so who is that individual? Where is he coming from? So once it's Judah is identified as it's going to come through Judah, then the statement of the one who is going to come from Judah, he's going to be a ruler. That's not, it would be understood, right? If we know that Messiah is coming through Judah, then that is understood. How did Jacob know that? That's built into the idea of the blessing. Like how in the same way, how does he know? How does he know that Zebulun will dwell at the seashore? Right, land hasn't been divided up yet. Right, they don't even know the boundaries of the land. They don't know any of that. So how does he know that Zebulun's going to be on the seashore? That's the nature of that blessing that's given at the end of the life. There's a prophetic quality to it. And not even just, I think this is going to happen, but there's something to do with, this, me giving this blessing brings this about, right? We saw all the way back with Noah and Canaan. We see it with Jacob and Esau and Isaac, Abraham giving blessing, so on and so forth. Yeah. Leo. Yeah, right.
So we don't see any trial, but we always see he's seeking the Lord.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But then being father of Pharaoh and then being in a very eminent place, he was able to survive compared to like Daniel in Babylon.
Exactly.
We don't see any example.
Right.
It's just like
trials. Yeah. And you see Daniel, like when Daniel goes into Babylon. It's like, I'm willing to give up my life for this, right? He almost loses his life in chapter 1, even with the food. Like, you can't do this. And he says, I won't compromise. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Interesting that we remember their Babylonian names, right? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Their actual Hebrew names, in the fiery furnace. So there's this trial of them like standing up and saying, no, we're not gonna compromise. We are going to follow after God. And the willing to give up their lives for that. Joseph is not viewed in that way. It says he's elevated to prominence because of an ability that he has, But what did his life look like then? He marries the daughter of a priest. That priest is not a priest of Yahweh. So he's marrying this woman, having Manasseh and Ephraim with this woman. She's the priest of, or she's the daughter of a high priest, apparently of a city.
Yeah, that'd be interesting
Thanksgiving. Yeah, right. Hey, what do you believe? What do I believe? Oh, you know, you believe in a God whose head is a crocodile. Like, I, you know, I, where do we go from here? So, yeah.
And the other thing I'd like to point out in regards to women. So, in the old, I mean, we see all these things in the Old Testament. We see the oral ruling. And then, but today, if you go live in those lands, it's still the same ruling. Because, you know, a woman cannot leave the house. A mother cannot leave the house unless there's a male.
Yeah.
That is the rule that is embedded into the culture.
Yeah.
And it even bled into like the, you know, the Muslim world, the, you know, every country in that area, it's been seen like that.
So, yeah.
You know, women are kind of seen like, okay, they just want to be the bearers of children. And then anything you want to go outside or do anything and you want, culturally, is completely different.
Yeah.
So if you don't have a male person present, you cannot leave your house.
And one other thing that I would say about that as well, in the Old Testament, women, the history and the stories that are told, women are not treated well, but that's not the intention, right? You have the image of God expressly placed, man and woman both created in the image of God. And so there's this idea of what ought to be, and then there's this idea of how are things actually functioning in a sin fall, you know, in a sin cursed world, right? And the horrible things that happen to women, that's a result of being in the, you know, in this side of Eden, right? Not out as it ought to be, but as it is. And what does that tell us about those who are supposed to be taking care of them, those who are supposed to be the ones who are helping? What does that tell us about them? Their role has been twisted. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, right? So it's the effects of sin that we see throughout in many different ways. We could ask the same thing about slavery, right? Why is there slavery? How is slavery dealt with in terms of even Leviticus and elsewhere, right? There is slavery. There is one person oppressing another person. And Solomon points this out in Ecclesiastes, right? I just see again and again oppression, 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 oppression because of sin within the world. Ought it to be that way? Absolutely not. Yes, sir.
So when Joseph went through his, like, being sold into slavery,
yeah.
Is that, I mean, he remembers the dream and that he's under God's blessing.
Yeah. 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 It's hard to get inside the mind of Joseph as he's going down into Egypt. He's a bit like a spoiled kid, not because he has the two dreams, right? And tells it, but because he tells his brothers and the way that he does tell his brothers and the, let me go, you know, tell on, like, he's viewed it not in a great way. But does he hold on to that truth? Like, I had these dreams when I was young, and that's going to like direct, you know, that God's going to be blessing me in some way in the future. Is he holding on to that as he goes down to Egypt? I would hope so. Yeah, but it's really hard to get inside of his mind. Yes, ma'am.
When Joseph says the dreams to his brothers, yeah, and to his father, he never interprets the dreams for them.
Right.
They already know what it means.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And that's where it gets really tricky, because you have dreams that are given, and it sometimes seems like they're at face value. Like Pharaoh's dream that he has. You know, 7 fat cows, 7 skinny cows. You're like, it's not super hard to get to famine and blessing for 7 years. Like, it's not a crazy thing to get from that dream. But Pharaoh's like, I have no idea what's going on. Like, how do I know what's going to happen? So some dreams, like Joseph's first two that he has with his brothers, is like, we just know exactly what's happening. Sheaves bowing down, sun, moon, and stars. Like, they just understood this is what the dream means. Didn't need to be interpreted. But then you have Pharaoh and even like the baker and the cupbearer's dream. You know, you're like, okay, there's a three, there's like, I can kind of get to that where we're going with this. So dream interpretation, we don't offer a class at the seminary, maybe we should, but I'm, I'm not, it comes up again and again in the Old Testament. Yeah.
It's just a little weird because the cows were 7 years.
Yeah, yeah.
The baskets were 3 days.
Exactly,
so
right. Years and days. Exactly, yeah, exactly right. Right, right, exactly. Yeah, exactly right. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Where it's identified, to my understanding.
Yeah.
Are you able to trace how that seed has been persecuted through time as opposed to the people who are not in the seed?
You can, of course, we can trace the history, right, of Israel as we go through, you know, all the way up until now. But other groups, not as much. Like Edom, you know, who's identifying as Edom today? There's, yeah, but like, is that the same? Is that different? Is it, it's really hard to trace, you know, trace the seed in that way.
The oppression of Satan against the seed, we can see that.
Yeah.
But as compared to the others.
Right.
It's not.
Yeah. It's not as visible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. We see other nations judged. Right, so many of the prophets speak about other nations, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. They'll point out, okay, here's what's Israel. Israel's to be judged because of their sin, but you'll have whole chapters on here's other nations and the judgment that's coming against them because of their wickedness too. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. No. No, no. See, that's where this it gets. She's not depicted as that being negative in some way. She's taken advantage of because she's alone, right? But the fact that she doesn't have to have a male with her 24 hours a day all the time, right? Women could go out and, you know, especially if they're going like visit the daughters of the land, something like that. There's nothing wrong with that. But because she doesn't have a male with her, she's viewed as being, you know, prey, like according to Shechem, right? And so she's taken advantage of because of that. If she would have had her father with her, Shechem wouldn't have been able to do what he did. It's not bad for what she did. Shechem just takes advantage of it because he's wicked. Yeah. Yes, sir?
Do you know who the Pharaoh was when Joseph
was? It's a very good question. Very good question. We're not exactly sure who the Pharaoh is. We think we have a good idea, or we think we know who the Pharaoh was in the Exodus. But the Pharaoh comes to, or the Pharaoh that's in with Joseph, we're not exactly sure who that is. But after that period, of course, there's a group that comes to power that says they didn't know Joseph. And the statement there is not like, who are these people? Where do they come from? They knew where they came from, but they didn't have allegiance to them anymore. So there's a dynasty change that happens, and you have several different dynasties within Egypt. And so there's a dynasty change that happens, and they say, who's Joseph? We don't care about him. We don't care about the Hebrews. That's what makes the transition into Exodus. Yep. Yes, sir?
The way that Joseph tests his brothers, deception.
And yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right,
yeah. It just presents it. It's hard to know whether Joseph testing his brothers is a positive and negative thing. Like, why didn't you just say, hey, guys, I'm Joseph? I think he wants to see how they're going to treat. That's why he's so emphatic on bringing Benjamin down, because he wants to see, how are you going to treat Benjamin? Right? They leave Simeon and they go back, and it's not until they run out of food that they come back to get Simeon. But they bring Benjamin with them. And then Joseph sets it up in such a way that it's either Benjamin or them, right? Like somebody's going to get punished. Somebody's head is on the line. It's either Benjamin or them. And he wants to see, are they going to give him up, right? And they don't in the second instance. Judah takes a role of the primary role in that. So the outcome of that is very good. But is it good for him to deceive his brothers in that way? That's just the story. It's how it's depicted, not necessarily positive or negative. Would I have done it differently? Maybe, but I'm not Joseph. So, yes, ma'am.
In the dream where it says that the sun and the moon and the stars would bow down to him,
Yeah.
How does that come to pass if his mother died before she could ever bow down?
Right, right, exactly. Because I think sun, moon, and stars bowing down to him is that he's providing for all of the family. So his mother has passed away by that time, but his father comes down. So it's viewed as all of the family I am providing for. I, in a sense, I'm the head of all of them because I'm the one who's the provider now, right? I'm the one who's taking care of everybody. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Just a note, Nathan, on the word Shiloh. I went to the Arabic translation.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank God I speak Arabic.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yep.
And brother, it's given a stronger meaning than the English language.
Mm.
It says English until which Shiloh comes, in the Arabic until the new king comes.
Oh, okay.
They even specify
yeah.
the mother.
Yeah, yeah.
The mother is king,
yeah, yeah.
The true or the peaceful king comes.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's good.
It's good.
I like that. I like that. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Shiloh is difficult. It's tricky. Like the word itself, there's a whole bunch of articles that are written on what exactly does the word mean, right? It's viewed as an individual, as a king who's going to come from Judah, but what exactly Shiloh is? Is it a name? Is it a, you know, there's all kinds of debate.
Is that the only place where it's used?
I believe so, but I need to double check that. I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah. Don't take that as gospel truth, though. All right, very good. I'll let you go. Any other questions? I'm happy to ask, but thanks for studying Genesis. So, all right.